Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Hi and welcome to this very special podcast. I'm Gavin Wood. My guest today is one of my all-time faves. This is the man in the white suit and the carnations and had those two monster hits, Never Gonna Fall in Love with You and I Wanna Make You My Lady. That's right, the great Mark Holden, who does a touchdown on Australian Idol. He's a singer, he's a songwriter, he's a great bloke, and he's next.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
I'm very excited in the Countdown Podcast to be talking to one of my mates, and also I was a big fan of his when he was on Countdown, giving out the carnations and singing those great songs. Mark Holden, hello.
Hey, Gavin, how you doing?
I'm good. So, back then, the heady days of Countdown. Do you wish you're still doing them?
We were so lucky to, find ourselves in that moment. It was a huge moment.
Yeah.
Everybody that was touched by it, it gave us something for our lifetimes, really. I think we've more or less come to the end of that celebration. I think we're pretty much done that. But
yeah,
because, the people like us are getting into our late 60s and 70s, you know, it's for us, it's like the kids, I say to the kids that are on Australian Idol, they will think of it in the same way when they're older, that they were lucky to have that moment where they made their name.
Well, let's go right back. Mark Ronald Holden. Any significance in the Ronald family name?
It's my dad's
right.
Name.
Okay. Singer, actor, record producer, TV personality, songwriter, and the most important one of all, I think, barrister.
Yes, well, later in life, a barrister. I went to the bar in 2009, and so I was at that point 55. So it took from starting my law degree to signing the bar role was 39 years.
Mm. Are you a slow learner?
That was a big gap here.
Now, let's go back. How did it all start? Where did you get your early musical influence? And how old were you when you realized you could sing?
Well, my father was a singer and he sang in the bathroom, and you'd hear him sometimes of a Sunday afternoon when there was a barbecue and some red had been consumed, he might strike up a song. And my mum played the piano. She enjoyed playing the piano, so she would play piano for Dad on, and occasionally for me. And then just my brother learnt the guitar, and then when he was done with that guitar, I picked it up. And it was always around. Music was always around the house. And I just naturally found myself trying to figure out how to write songs and how to play songs and then singing in the pancake parlor and at school and things like that. And then during my first shot at university, I started doing some gigs. You know, I started doing some folk gigs and I had one job as a barman where I'd jump the bar and sing some songs and over the years that became something that actually I could make a living from.
Mm.
And then in my very last year of law school, I dropped out. I actually went to Sydney and tried to do it at UNSW. I was on tour and that was 74. I got a show on the ABC called Target, which was a young people show, and I had a radio show as well. So I found myself living from entertainment, and the law just fell away at that
right.
point.
I want to stay back in your youth. What school did you go to?
I was at Pringer Park Primary, firstly, down in Brighton, and then in Adelaide, and then went to high school at a Methodist boys' school called Westminster, and I got a part scholarship.
Right.
To go there, and my brother went there as well. I liked it there. It wasn't like St. Peter's College or Prince Alfred College. It wasn't, it was a much more sort of middle class, and it was Methodist in the old way of Methodist, which was, you know, plain man's book of prayers kind of thing. And, and, you know, we wore a suit and I liked that. I, in retrospect, I liked the fact that we all wore suits and ties and that we were all more or less, you know, there was, it was classless because we all wore a gray suit and a green shirt and a green tie. So no, I really enjoyed my time at school and had a band at school and was in all the, you know, the plays and the, and we, our little band played at the Fete and, that was a very happy time for me, I'd have to say. And surfing, you know, we'd go down the coast surfing and it was a really good school. I had a terrific upbringing there.
So like Ross Wilson, you had a band at school. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always loved playing with my brother. My brother was always my hero and
what's
still
his,
is.
What's his name?
His name is Craig Holden, and he's the current lead singer of the Masters Apprentices. He's 70 years old, and the original Masters, you know, are an Adelaide band.
Yeah,
obviously, and they've you know, reconstituted, and my brother's a developer and a very successful developer, and but this is what, you know, he's been, always been a musician. He was in the Moonshine Jug and String Band with the Brewster Jones brothers before they became the Angels. And and I grew up going to the Moonshine Jug and String Band gigs.
So Adelaide, similar to Brisbane, had a thriving music scene, but
Melbourne, Valentine's.
Melbourne was always the king, but there was a lot of great talent in Adelaide.
Oh, there was a lot of great talent. My sister used to go out with a guy called Hamish Henry, who managed Fraternity.
Oh, great.
I mean, Fraternity were an enormous band. And of course, Bon Scott was the lead singer.
Seasons of Change. What a great song.
Yeah. What a great song.
So tell me about the family. You're reviving the circus, or
my father used to tell us the stories around the dining room table. We had a round dining room table.
Yeah.
Dad would sometimes regale us with stories of his great uncle Adolphus Holden, who he claimed had one leg, and was a trapeze artist. And that just sounded like
a one-legged, you know, trapeze artist.
He was a one-legged trapeze artist.
I love it.
Which just sounded unbelievable. You know, it just didn't sound like there was any element of truth in it. But and he told us about the Holden Brothers Traveling Circus.
Yeah.
His mother was a Presbyterian, and of course the circus people were Catholic. And back in those days, that actually meant something. And so Dad and his sickly father would only see the circus Holdens at funerals, essentially. And we didn't have I didn't know them. I didn't meet them. But then when I became successful, a couple of them reached out to me in the '70s, but you know, at that age, I was in my 20s and I wasn't all that interested. And
I could understand but then, your career was blowing up.
Yeah, but it just for whatever I was just on a path and I wasn't going to be diverted. But later on, when I was after living in Los Angeles for 16 years, Bert Newton called me from Good Morning Australia and did a remote out of Los Angeles, and he held up an Australasian post with pictures of the Holden Circus and then a picture of me as the Carnation Boy in amongst it all. And he asked me if it was true, and I said, I think it is true. I mean, I don't know them, but I think it is true. Well, somebody, one of the family saw that, and I was making a record with David Hasselhoff in New York, and they reached out to me again and said that they were having a family reunion at the Holy Rosary Church in Kensington in Melbourne. And would I be able to come? Well, I thought, and I just thought, you know what? I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
sounds
and the Hoff was lovely. And, you know, he said, you know, go and take a week off and, you know, go down and see them. And, I flew down, I met them and I met, Mick Holden, and, Mick was in all kinds of bands. He was in the Mixtures. He was in the Hot City. He was in the Hot City Bump band. Gee. He was, you know, he was in all these great Melbourne bands. And his sons are musicians, and we just immediately hit it off.
Mm.
And his grandfather was Adolphus, the one-legged trapeze artist.
Okay.
Actually, he was a one-legged slack wire artist, and he did a triple bar act.
What's a triple bar act?
Well, it's essentially you know, you have the bars and you swing and you throw yourself, you know, and it's a
then you do a somersault.
It's an aerialist. We're talking about 1890s. It's a beautiful, beautiful story, but it's also the story of you know, the original Holden coming to the Bellarine and settling at Indented Head, right where John Batman first landed. He was one of the first dispossessors of the Wathaurong. So the story then became, for me, a journey of discovering what this dispossession really meant. And I remembered meeting my grandfather's brother in the 60s, and him and my grandfather were selling off their father's land to survive the depression in the 1930s, and send my dear old dad to Scotch College. You know,
It sounds like a book and a documentary.
It is a book. I've written the book, and I wrote the book last year. And,
is it published yet?
No, I'm just trying. I've got to get to. I use Wathaurong language and I use Gunditjmara language, and so I'm seeking counsel and advice. I've given it to a friend of mine who's works down at the Wathaurong Centre, and I've given it to a couple of other Wathaurong people. And I've now given it to a Gunditjmara man I know, and I'm just allowing those people to lead me to the next people, just so that I get a sense of whether the story I'm retelling is, it's really my great grandfather's story, and then his kids, which were the circus, and so it's really my story as well. But in telling their story. I'm very aware that I don't want to be like my great grandfather Samuel, and just be another dispossessor of their story.
Yeah,
you know?
I see a great film in this too.
It's an extraordinary story. It is an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Mate, let's get back to your music and your career. You left school, you were singing in folk cafes and all of that, and your first appearance on the Ernie Sigley Show. How did you feel?
Well, Ernie was. I still regard Ernie as my first big break.
Yeah, he broke Ernie, a lot of people.
He was really my first major big thing that happened in my career. I lined up and I sang him an original song, and then he started using me in Adelaide. And not long after that, he went to Melbourne and he took me to Melbourne, and that was a big deal. You know, we stayed at the Park Royal down near the Women's Hospital there, and it felt very exotic. You know,
yes.
So I mean, being flown to Melbourne, and you know, and then
staying
in a
hotel,
taxi to a hotel, and somebody else is paying for it. And Ernie just kept on using me. I remember distinctly going, and that's where I met Jack Strom. And Jack, of course, between the two of us, Jack and I, we discovered Vanessa and had an incredible run together as business partners.
He used to do Red Faces on Hey
Hey.
Used to
do Red Faces, that's right. Well, I knew him from when he was the floor manager on Ernie.
Right, of course.
And we would go back to Ernie's place in South Melbourne. And have a drink after the show, And that, I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. I mean, seriously, yeah, lovely, that's amazing.
Lovely guy.
When you think about that, just the, and the beautiful Glenys, who's you know, was there then and is still now.
We love you, Ernie. Now, mate, tell me about the white dinner suit. Did that kind of germinate from the Ernie Sigley show?
No, I was strictly a folky on Ernie, and I was a folky on Showcase 74 as well, because. Yeah, I did the Gordon Boyd thing.
Gordon Boyd.
Yeah, that's right.
What a show.
And of course Hector. It was Hector's opportunity to play with an orchestra. That was what the show was about. Hector just wanted to conduct an orchestra, but it was really Leslie Myers that was sitting behind there. He was really the John Foreman of the
real MD.
He was the real MD. But that was another big show for me, and of course that was national. That was truly national. You know, that was shown in all of the Channel 9. It was a national show, that one. What happened was that we were doing the first video for Never Gonna Fall in Love Again, and I happened to, for whatever reason, it was in Sydney, and I think it might have even been Paul Drain that shot it, and it was probably for Countdown, I would think. And they probably what EMI did was they paid Paul Drain to make it in the kind of a backhanded, you know, passing the money kind of situation.
Was that with Peter Dawkins too?
Well, Peter was the producer and Peter was the guy who discovered me.
Right.
And he we made an album that came out before that. And it was a flop. It was all my original songs from up till that time, kind of orchestrated by a guy called Bill Motzik, and Peter Dawkins produced it. But it was a giant stiff. And so then I was offered this song, Never Gonna Fall in Love Again, the cover, you know, the cover and the Eric Carmen cover.
Right.
And Paul came up to Sydney and shot it in this beautiful house in Hunter's Hill, and it was this old sort of colonial house, and so I wore cricket creams and braces and a kind of a hippie grandpa shirt, and that's where it started.
I remember that.
And that was the kind of romantic look. And then there was a company called Hardy Amy's, who made suits, and I just riffed on that and got Hardy Amy's double breasted suit. And then I made the round neck collars from the Picnic at Hanging Rock era type collars.
Yeah.
And it was sort of constructed in that way, and Never Gonna Fall in Love Again became a hit, and then I Wanna Make You My Lady was where Countdown and I really connected. And by that time, that was where I had the Hardy Amy suit and that whole one where I'm pulled down off the stage. And it was lovely because the vault in Melbourne at the Arts Centre has that room where you go in and there's video in each wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the first one, it's not there anymore, but the first one had, me in that carnation, you know, that carnation moment and being pulled off the stage at Countdown is one of the classic Countdown moments. And it certainly was. And that's when it all connected, and the whole carnation thing, you know, was an accident and it happened then. And it just, you know, Countdown just blew it up. I mean, it just blew it up.
I think you get the title for the longest titles of singles. Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. I Wanna Make You My Lady. Last Romance. Well, that's a short one. And then Reach Out for the One Who Loves You.
Last Romance was a B. Birtle song.
Right.
And that's a detail that's sort of strangely connecting, Beeb and I. And in fact, Beeb married a girl I lived with for a while in Los Angeles. So our
Donna.
Lives have been. How like Donna, yes.
Yeah.
Donna, I lived with Donna for a while.
Good. Okay. Well, look, yeah. I want to now take you to the transition of being a pop star.
Yeah.
So tell me about that feeling of being a pop star in the 70s.
It was so brilliant and so fabulous because so many opportunities were being presented every day. and you got paid, you know, and just money just turned up, you know, out of the air, you know, just checks would turn, you know, you'd get a check for this and a check for that, and you'd go off. I went off and did blankety blanks.
Yeah.
And you know, and that check would turn up.
Young Doctors.
It wasn't like it was
Greg
work.
Greg Mason and the Young Doctors.
Oh, I did the Young Butchers. you know, and that was fantastic.
Blue Fire Lady, Newsfront.
Blue Fire Lady, yeah, no, Newsfront. It was just fantastic. It was just one fantastic experience after another. And I just, you know, and those two of my albums were platinum, and that was enough in those days. I was able to buy a house for cash. I bought my grandparents' house for cash at the age of like 24.
How good,
you know,
is that?
Good is that, man? It's just, it was extraordinary that I just had this incredible run, and then you know, I went. What's his name? John Reed.
He was a judge. He was a judge with you on Australian Idol.
He did. Yeah. Yes, it was. It's a strange how the world turns. But he called me to the Siebel Townhouse in 1977, and he summoned me. Bring me the boy. And
that could be dangerous.
And I, yes, that's right. It could have been dangerous. And but he just said, "Hey, Elton's, you know, looking to sign people to Rocket Records. Would you be interested?" I said,
wow,
"Sure, of course
yeah.
I would." And I flew to London. Peter Ricks was my manager at that time, and Rixie and I flew to London, and we got picked up at the airport by a white Rolls Royce. We were taken to Elton's, you know, place in Knightsbridge, and then we went off to the Eagles gig at Wembley at the height of Hotel California. Sure. Then we came back that night, having not gone to bed yet, and having gotten off a 24-hour flight from Australia. And we're standing around the piano after the gig, and everyone's saying, because Elton had sat in with the Eagles, and they ask, you know, what did you think? And everyone's going, how fantastic he was. And, you know, Elton, you're brilliant. Comes to me, and I said, gee, I thought the band were good, but I don't know about the piano player.
Oh. And he believed you?
And they never spoke to me again.
Oh, they don't get our sense of humour still.
Like I took Rixie all the way to London, which was a long way away in those days.
Yeah.
And in less than 8 hours, I had the entire thing up.
Oh, Mark.
I know.
But you weren't to know, because they didn't get your humour. You know, that's sad,
I guess,
that they didn't,
yeah.
You know. That.
I know. But what an opportunity I missed
out
on that.
You then hightailed it to L.A., in the 80s,
yes.
And
yes,
very successful over there. Songwriting for Meatloaf.
It started out, I was signed to a company called the Scotti Brothers, who had Leif Garrett, and they were trying to find a new Leif Garrett, and they figured I was it. And I was signed to them for 2 years. Didn't end up working, but it wasn't because of them that it didn't work. They got me this incredible opportunity to be a star of the future in the Diamond Jubilee of Hollywood special on CBS, and we put together a song that I had written. It wasn't really a great song, and the about a day before my wisdom teeth blew up, and we're going, and it's live to air. There's nothing I can do about it, you know. And so they filmed me a little bit before. They filmed me arriving on Hollywood Boulevard in a bus. Kind of like the kid from Kansas or something like that. And I met at Grauman's Chinese by Betty Davis.
Hmm.
The real Betty Davis.
She was there.
That was the film that they were shooting. Betty Davis.
Oh, I see. Right.
And she was meeting me at from the bus. That was how they were setting up my appearance. Yeah. Which was quite, I mean, it was extraordinary. So it wasn't anything. The Spotties did everything that they promised. But by this time, the side of my jaw is like a balloon, and I'm on multiple painkillers.
Poor thing.
And the show went to air, and the song was a complete dud, and they dropped me. So I found myself in 1982 on my ass in L.A., and I'd gotten out of my deal with EMI to sign with to sign with the Scotti Brothers, which was Atlantic Records. Yeah. And I had no deal and nothing. And I was just there on the Pat Malone in LA, and I had to figure out what I was going to do. And I just didn't want to come back yet and have my tail between my legs. And so it took me a while, but in 1984, I had my first hit with the Temptations as a songwriter. And that was a big breakthrough moment for me. That was being out, because I'd never written any of my own hits in Australia. Right. And to come to America and to go through that deep growth and deep sort of spiritual growth and become a proper songwriter, and then to be in the room with the Temptations while they were recording and to work out harmony parts with them. Fantastic. And then for the thing to become a hit. It's on the Hitsville, USA, you know, Motown Greatest Hits collection, which is an enormous honor for me as a songwriter. And
what's the song called?
It's called Lady Soul.
So you learned how to condense the title. That's very good.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that was a transformative moment for me.
Oh, yeah.
Because that gave me the confidence and gave me an income. And it gave me the confidence to throw myself into songwriting.
And so because of that, you know, Meatloaf, Joe Cocker, Gladys Knight, Bob Welch, The Hoff, they all came running to you.
The Hoff was a fantastic experience. We had such a great time with David, my wife and I, and we had just had a fantastic time with David. He was so generous to us, and you know, again, you know, we were running around Europe with him, and I was advancing his records and making his records. You know, I would do his vocals with him, and we'd send his vocals off to guys in Germany, and it was a really, really, really good time. And we had a hit that we wrote together in Germany, and another one in Holland, and that was a really lovely, lovely, lovely time. So it was really good. And that was right at the end of that time was when Katie was born, and she was born in LA. And at that, once Katie was born, I decided it was time to go home. I wanted to leave, and I wanted her to grow up in Australia. And
was that around the LA riots, around that time?
LA riots was at the time that I was working I was a partner in a management company that was, I had two black partners, and we found young producers in Compton and Watts,
right.
Put them over to Burbank, put them in an apartment, managed them, and made records. You know, we worked, you know, I was working with the Temptations. We had a number one record with Kathy Sledge. We had a number one record with her. So that was a good time too. But, you know, I mean, I loved it. But I was on the corner of Florence and Normandy, where Reginald Denny got his head smashed in with a brick.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Tom's Liquor Store on that corner. And I used to go to Tom's Liquor Store, because I didn't have a mobile phone in those days, and to get into the studio where the guys I was, you know, I was managing were banging out the tracks, they never answered the door, and the studio was out the back of this dude's father's house.
Okay.
And so I they would never answer the door, so I had to go call, and so I'd find myself standing at this call box at Tom's Diner, right on that corner. With a light over my head, and I had a briefcase at that time, and I must have looked like a drug dealer, and it must have looked like that was a bag full of cash. It was a bag full of cassettes.
You were lucky you didn't get rolled.
I was very bloody lucky, God. Man. I had the luck of the Australian, because I was so naive at that time. I mean, I'd been there 12 years already, but I was so naive that you know, that I just didn't feel that I was going to get knocked off. But really, I could easily have been, because Reginald Denny on that exact same corner, you know, got his head smashed in with a brick, which was the start of the LA riots. Yeah. So,
the whole thing's turned full circle, because Katie's now back in LA and she's got a brilliant job.
She is. Yeah, no, Katie's got another week here in Australia. She's working it from 3 a.m. in Melbourne to be, what's that, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning LA. So she works from 9 in the morning LA till, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening in LA, but from Melbourne at the moment. And it's just killing her. So she's going to go back. She's going to go back in a week because she's already got signed up and she's signed up for the Pfizer shot within a week of her getting back to LA. So a lot of her friends have already had it. And, so it's a safer place for her to be. Once she's, I'll be happy once she's had the shot, I'll be happy. So, but it's just killing her. She can't. You know, it's 3 in the morning. It's just
too
much.
Now, she works for the biggest agency in the world, probably, William Morris, correct?
No, she did. She did work for William Morris, and she worked for the boss of William Morris. And but now she works at Disney, and she's in TV development.
Oh, that's huge.
She's in the development team of... in Disney, because Disney Plus has got, you know, it's one of the big streaming services, and they've got Hulu, and they've got a number of different, you know, streaming services.
Right. Well, that's just huge. Now you've got another.
And her apartment is about 500 yards from my wife's apartment when I was chasing after her, you know, in 1982.
Small world.
Isn't that bizarre?
Now, Kane, your son, what's he doing?
He's here in Melbourne. Uh-huh. He works for the state government here in Victoria, and he's loving it. He's loving being here, and it's fantastic that him and I are in the same city.
Yeah.
For really the first time. He was in LA with my wife and I in 1992 during the LA riots. So he was working at A&M at that point and in the studio there at the Charlie Chaplin lot. And he was there during the riots. Gee. And then there was a big earthquake around that time. And then he just said, I can't stand it anymore, and just came home to Australia.
I don't blame him. That's why you and I came home.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Now, let's get back to Mark Holden, the pop star. You're the first pop star in the world to play the lead in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yeah, I know. That was fantastic. Yes, it was really good. And really, The Young Doctors was shown on Channel 4 in England, but they didn't tell us.
Right.
And if I'd been able to connect those dots in those days, I only found out it was on because much later on in the 80s, I went over there to my English publisher, and I walked in the door of my English publisher, and the girl on the desk said, "Young Dr. Craig." I said, "Are you Australian?" She said, no, we watched it on Channel 4.
Oh, gee.
And no one bothered telling us. And, of course, we never, ever got a residual, never once.
And you could have capitalized on it and gone over there.
I could have capitalized on it and done a Jason and Kylie. Well, we're exactly right. Anyway, that's how life panned out. But certainly that was another opportunity that unfortunately slid.
Well, there's a King of Pop award with Mark Holden's name for most popular new talent on it. Congratulations for that. You've also won a couple of Logie Awards for most popular Australian TV teenage personality and best new talent. And you won the teenage pop personality twice.
I've got three Logies on my shelf, as well as being a part of a number of others with Idol, because we won as a show a number of times as well. They were good days. They were very, very good days.
They had
down at the Southern Cross down here in Melbourne.
Yeah,
remember the old Southern Cross?
Yes, where the Beatles stayed. The old
yes.
place. And the Logie Awards always came out of the Southern Cross.
That's where
Hotel.
The Logies
were. Now, to do 5 seasons of Australian Idol as a judge, you know, I mean, that is an unbelievable thing these days. 5 seasons of a big show.
There's a number of them that get used. Delta gets used a lot. I would think Guy's probably done 10 seasons of different shows. There's a lot of people who have done a lot more seasons than for me, and Marcia Hines being one of them.
Yeah, dear Marcia.
And, she was on every season. Mm. So, I loved it, and it was devastating when I was fired. And, I'm sure you've been fired any number of times, Gavin. It never gets easy.
Ernie Sigley always used to say, you haven't made it until you've been fired 17 times. and it's true. I mean, the first
it is true, but
first
it doesn't,
couple of hard...
it always hurts, though.
Oh, it does.
It does hurt.
Yeah.
Now, it does hurt.
You also did a season on The X Factor with Mr. Reed, Elton's manager.
Yes, unfortunately, that show didn't really work when we did it. They bookended it between two seasons of Idol, and it just didn't really work. It was there was overexposure at the time. What Channel 10 wanted to do is they wanted to neuter the show so that it wouldn't go up against Idol.
Right. Okay.
And then, of course, eventually it went to Channel 7.
Now, after that, you've done radio on Nova. You've played Lee Gordon in Shout.
I loved
Johnny O'Keefe story.
Lee Gordon in Shout. That was really great. And one of the best things about Shout for me was just having the opportunity to work with, you know, John Paul Young, for example, Glenn Shorrock.
Right.
Hearing Glenn Shorrock sing every night.
Mm-hmm.
Colleen.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, Colleen, yeah. I'd never really knew Colleen before Shout.
Yeah.
And Colleen is just a force of nature. She's on stage every night. She is incredible.
Colleen Hewitt with that big booming voice
much
control.
But also the stagecraft and everything. She is a hell of a woman. And, it was an enormous pleasure to get to know her and watch the interaction between her and Glenn every night, because they were playing husband and wife.
Yeah.
And Colleen is such a, you know, the way that the director tells you to do it, that's the way you do it every night. And Glenn's a rock and roller. Glenn's in the moment, and it might be, he might sing it differently tonight than he did last night, or he might not stand in the exact same place.
Yeah.
And Colleen was ready to knock his bloody block off. It was so fantastic. He'd forget, be sitting in his dressing room, forget to come on. Mm. You know, Colleen would be literally ready to punch him in the face.
Now to take it down just a slight touch, you had thyroid cancer. With a beautiful voice like yours, that must have been a real worry.
Yes, it destroyed my voice. It was it never bothered me, but in over the course of time, you know, I've still continued to do some singing with my brother, but I don't get a pleasure out of it because it's a new voice but it's just my old voice was the older I got, the better it got. And I was really enjoying singing. And now, you know, when I sing, I can sing Shine, the song I wrote with Vanessa, that was her hit. I can sing that one for some reason. But the old songs, have too much range and about 80% of my voice is gone. It's not really. I mean, you know, the alternative is far worse.
That's true.
Very bloody lucky. When I was going under, I said to the surgeon, mate, go long, go deep. You know, and
I would never have said that.
I wanted him to slice all that shit out of me.
Yeah.
And I believe he did, because I've had 10 years with no recurrence. So,
congratulations,
you know,
mate. That's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah.
So
I don't regret it, and in fact that's when I had my surgery just after I was admitted to the bar.
Right.
And so when I was first, you know, recuperating, I'd go and do an appearance at the bar with my neck all swollen and I could talk.
Right.
And so I could still use my voice, and I had this new career, and it didn't involve singing, and it just involved my brain and speaking. So, you know, that was, it is a loss. There's no doubt about it. Not being able to sing not be able to sing well, but I still sing. I'm a member of the Savage Club, and we do, we do, you know, nights, and they'll get me along, and I'll sing in those circumstances where
right.
everybody's fully inebriated, and it's not a professional gig. It's right. it's members of the club who are playing and members of the club who are singing to members of the club.
Yeah.
So it's more of an amateur, you know, good. It's like right. a men's shed with a good wine list, you know.
All right. Well, look, we're coming nearly to the end, but I was in L.A. in 2008. I got there in 2007, and I missed Dancing with the Stars.
Right.
Now, I understand.
You missed it, man.
I understand you were brilliant.
Well, there was a narrow minority of people who thought it was brilliant. The vast majority, including Channel 7, thought it was disgraceful, and that I was absolutely destroying the format and being disrespectful.
Right.
But the truth of the matter is, I really don't like dancing, and I'm absolutely horrible at it.
Right.
And I told them that going in. I said, look, here's the thing. I'll do this because, you know, I'll do it because I was trying to promote this circus film I made,
yeah.
and which didn't work because it was totally counterproductive, and I just Channel 7 were trying to tell me, don't do this, it's going to ruin your career, and I said, here's the thing, you know, I don't have a mortgage,
yeah,
you're never going to hire me. There's nothing you can do to stop me.
Oh, isn't that a good feeling?
But there was one
feeling
thing that they could do. There's one thing that they could do.
What's that?
And that, well, they organized that I got the lowest score of any contestant in any series in any country ever.
Oh, wear it like a badge. That's great.
Yeah, I did. but because the problem with shows like that is you can't vote against somebody.
Right.
You know, you have to vote for someone.
Uh-huh.
So the problem was there were enough people to keep me going for 3 weeks because people would just vote for me, that small group of people who just thought, this is crazy.
Yeah.
I love it. and that those small group of people continued to vote for me. You know?
Incredible.
So the only way they could do it was make the judges score virtually zero, you know.
Mm. Well, Mark, you've had an incredible career. I mean, this podcast is running longer than what I anticipated, and I'm so happy for that because I've learned so much about you. And
good on you, Gav.
I'm sure everybody listening has learned a lot about
yes.
you, mate. So before we go, we have the top 10 questions.
Go ahead.
Just like Countdown. So question number one, who inspired you to make music?
I think I did.
That's a good answer. Question number two, what have you learnt over the musical journey?
Many, many things. That if you're going to be, I'd say that my number one takeaway is, if you're going to be in any creative field, musician, actor, writer, marry well.
Good advice. What was the effect of Countdown to your career?
Absolutely pivotal. Changed my life.
Next question, if you could open up a show for any artist, who would it be?
Wow. No, I wouldn't want to open up a show for anyone at the moment, to be honest.
Next question, name your three dinner guests, dead or alive.
My three dinner guests, dead or alive. My father.
Right.
I'd love to have another conversation with him.
Hallelujah.
I love Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
And you know who I really, really adore nowadays? Taylor Swift, man. I love those two Taylor Swift records she put out last year. I think she is exquisite.
Isn't she good to her fans? I mean, she is, you know, if my daughters were growing up now and they had Taylor Swift as their role model, I'd be as happy as a clam.
Yes, yes. Well, I followed the journey with my daughter. My daughter's 25. We went to her, a guy called Rob Potts, who is he's fortunately gone now, a promoter. I knew it. He was a country dude and he did country gigs. And he brought her out for her very first tour where she just did clubs. And it was her kind of promo tour.
Yeah.
And I got to go to Billboard in the city. And I took Katie and I went to Billboard in the city with 200 people and saw her band and her right at the very start. And, you know, we were, you know, 10 feet from her. And then we've seen her at Rod Laver, and we've followed her. And this last year, the records she's made are so beautiful and so fabulous.
Good.
I'm a huge fan of hers.
Next question in the top 10. What is your favorite song, or what was your favorite song to perform back then?
I loved singing Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. That's a beautiful song. It's a great melody. It's a great, great classic melody and a beautiful pop song.
Next question. What is the most trouble you've ever gotten into? You don't have to answer this. A lot of people have said no to this one.
Most trouble I've ever gotten into. When I was a boy, and I think of how terrible I was to my parents, really. I was so horrible to my parents, who were just loving, good, honest, hardworking, ordinary people. And my mate over the back fence and I just do not understand why you would do this. But my mate and I, there was a bowl full of cherries on the dining room table, and we had a cherry fight. And we had a cherry fight in the living room. And the cherries were hitting the walls, and all the walls were stained with, you know, in the living room. I mean, what
a couple kind of ferals of, you turned out to be.
What kind of asshole? What kind of asshole does that? Really?
That's funny, man.
I just cannot imagine what on earth
and
I was thinking.
Did you have
thinking.
A prayer meeting with your parents afterwards?
No, the old man never once hit me.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Never once. He never did. I mean, I definitely felt his wrath on that day, but it was not physical.
Yeah,
it was. He never used physical violence. But I certainly understood that he was not happy.
Jan. Now, if you could change anything about the music industry, what would you do?
No, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change it. The music industry has been as troubled as it is, and as inequitable as it is. It's been so good to me. I'm so grateful to have had the years that I've had and the success that I've had that's been able to sustain me and my family. And now having done 10 years at the bar and being involved in people's very serious problems and seeing the other side of life and, you know, coming home feeling really stressed and anxious and just seeing the ugly side of human beings. I value the beauty I've had in the music business so much, and the moments that I've had of just, you know, absolutely everybody becoming a hit all around the world. Shine being the number one most played song in Australia in 2001. I can't believe I did that.
Congratulations.
I cannot believe I did that.
She still is a very exceptional singer. Vanessa Amorosi.
She is. She is an extraordinary singer. She's a world-class singer. Yeah, I agree. So that, you know, no, I wouldn't change anything, even though it's been inequitable and it's difficult. That's the nature of free enterprise and the nature that we're not all created equal in terms of talent. But, you know, my talent is super modest and I've been able to make it work. By years and years and years of, you know, all those 10,000 hours. There's been many, many batches of 10,000 hours. And that's, I think, just my sheer stickability has gotten me through to, you know, the once you have, and I'm sure you've experienced this in your professional life too, we go through troughs. But once you go through one trough and get back on another wave and you see that it's possible to get through troughs and get to the next wave, it gives you a confidence that, you know, when times are slow or that there is, you know, still another wave.
Makes
you
humble.
Catch.
Now, Mark Holden, two more questions to go. What is the best show that you've ever done?
What is the best show that I've ever done? I'd have to say Countdown. Yeah, Countdown. Countdown's the quality of the production of Countdown. It was so high, the level of care the people that worked on it. And I don't just mean, you know, the people, you know, the floor managers, the level of talent. And when Vanessa was on the BBC for Top of the Pops, when absolutely everybody was top 10 in England, and I got to see how Top of the Pops was done. And she did Top of the Pops in Germany a number of times too. And I got to see what, you know, BBC, man, Top of the Pops. And it was such a crap production compared to Countdown. Oh, really, it was.
I'll have to tell the crew. And final question, Mark Holden. What have you learnt, and what would you pass on to a young, hopeful musician?
I would say, apart from marry well, I would say this is the other piece of advice that I've plumbed, that if you do something that you love well enough, long enough, magically money follows.
Mark Holden, you are a rock star, and I love you like a brother. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Hey, good on you, Gav.
Gavin Wood's Countdown podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.